Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I am your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 140 with Chris Benson on the benefits of scaling to a $350 million portfolio in self-storage. As CIO of Reliant Real Estate, Chris helps fund the nearly $100 million per year acquisition appetite of this investment machine. Chris brings a ton of insight here, which applies to you and I, even if we're not already doing self-storage or intend to, or hundreds of millions of dollars in deals. Of course, the best way to get to that next level is to observe and model the mindset of those who are already operating at that level. At least that's my personal approach to this episode. So, ready, set, go. All right. Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. Chris, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Dan. Appreciate you having me.
Nice. So most of my listeners are bored of me saying that I'm recording from Chicago here, overlooking Lake Michigan, but my guests are from all over the country. So whereabouts in the U.S., I assume, you're recording from today?
I am indeed. We're actually in Roswell, Georgia, just outside of Atlanta.
Nice. One of our favorite hot markets right now for single family. So cool. Chris, for those listeners who may not know who you are, do you want to kind of give the background, Reader's Digest, maybe the story that led up to what you're doing today, and then what your investment and real estate business is looking like currently?
Yeah, can absolutely do that. So I'll start where I am, then I'll give you a little background about how I got here. So I'm the Chief Investment Officer at Reliant Real Estate. We are a commercial self-storage operator. As I mentioned, our corporate headquarters is in Roswell, Georgia, kind of northwest of Atlanta. We buy and manage our own self-storage facilities across the southeast. We have 51 properties as of yesterday in the portfolio, primarily in Florida, Georgia, Carolinas. We have a little portfolio in Alabama and Arkansas as well. And actually Tennessee. Sorry, I got to add that to the list. We just closed on our first two properties in Tennessee. So, my business is self-storage now. But I have a pretty diverse background, Dan. I came from, a sales background, had a number of corporate sales jobs, most recently at Intuitive Surgical. They manufacture the Da Vinci robot for some of your listeners who may know what that is. Pretty incredible technology. If you don't, you should Google it. And so that company was my last corporate job. And about 10 years ago, I got into real estate through a path I think most of us do, right? Where you follow the residential real estate first, had a portfolio of duplexes. We moved on to commercial multifamily. And then we did some investing in syndications and multifamily across the U.S. And then about 3 years ago, got involved in self-storage as the multifamily market, you know, cap rates have continued to compress and it's gotten more and more competitive. And so found a great partner in Todd Allen. He's actually the founder of Reliant. He and another guy, Lou Pollock, founded the company. And I joined about 18 months ago managing the equity arm of the business. And so my job really is around helping on the acquisition side, understand what properties we're going to be purchasing with our acquisitions team. And then I also run the equity arm of the business. So we do most of our properties with equity investors. And so that's really my role is managing the equity platform for Reliant. Does that help? Does that give us a good start?
It does. Yeah, it does. Cool. So we have a couple different things I want to talk about. But first, the progression through those variety. Do you still hang on to some of those duplexes and those single families in your own portfolio, or did you like shed the weight as part of this decision and evolution?
Yeah, so I have one duplex left. I actually have a family member who lives in it. So it's the reason I still own that one. And in the multifamily space, there's a 64-unit apartment complex we actually built from the ground up. That I'm a partner in, and then I'm a passive investor still in two multifamily properties that we haven't divested from in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex.
And I guess that's on the way at some point?
As far as the disposition of those assets?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they were both value-add properties, so we're almost complete with the renovations. You know, as you know, in value-add multifamily, it takes a little while to get the units turned. So we're still going through that process, but the market has come to meet us there as projected. As you probably know, Dan, Dallas, fantastic market, and our projected rents were actually exceeding on most of the renovated units. So that project's going really well, and yeah, there'll be a liquidity event here at some point.
Nice. Yeah, I am a single family guy. We do a lot of flips. We've closed 120 deals, 123 deals to date. It's August 23rd right now, and we've got close to 100 properties in our inventory. So we do a ton of those. And like my personal portfolio consists of mostly a bunch of small single families and like a 10 unit building that's supposed to be an 8 unit building. I'm going to court and probably going to lose my 2 units. I'm of the mindset of like, you know, a little more, I don't want to have to do the huge turnovers. We're flipping houses. You know, there's a nice liquidity event. Every time you flip a house, if you do it profitably, there's, you know, pretty solid payday there, and it can be an exciting time and exciting business. And a lot of our listeners like to do that stuff.
Sure.
Myself, I've been in the business like 13 years, and with my portfolio, I don't really want to renovate them to drive the rents up because I'm kind of busy renovating in my main business. So I like the hands off and the lower, capex that's involved, at least for me, and kind of just, it's an inflation hedge in a sense. I try to pick in the right areas where I think I'm buying in advance of gentrification, and it's worked out well. Some of these properties have gone up 40-50% in a 3-year period. I'm okay with that, mm-hmm. especially not having to have done 60-70,000 in renovations. But is self-storage and your attraction to that business model something similar to what I just described, or is there another reason behind your evolution into self-storage besides the compression of cap rates?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's kind of, you know, I would say the three pillars as to why I fell in love with the asset class. And if you want, I'll go through them really quickly. And I can, I'm a data guy, so I can get you access to the data sets that we used or that I used in my initial homework. But, you know, I like the National Association of REIT data. It's a longstanding data set, that you can compare asset class by asset class. And so, if you look at, NARIT data, on storage, the storage REITs have performed at just under 17% a year for the last 25 years, on average. So it's been a pretty substantial return. And then, you know, I compare that, I baseline that against apartments, which I was doing a fair amount of. And, you know, apartments did just under 13%, which is still fantastic, but I was shocked by how well storage had done. And then secondly, the thing that really stood out to me was, you know, I like to know what happens. I believe everything in the market is cyclical. And so if it's happened, if it's going to happen again, it's already happened in the past. And, you know, we're long into a bull market. So my expectation is we're going to have a downturn here very soon. And so I wanted to see what happened to the asset class in that last market downturn. So 2007, 8, and 9, storage lost less than 4% of the market or 4% of its value. Apartments was just under 7. And to give you a baseline, just the public equities market, the S&P 500 lost just over 22% in those same 3 years. So, you know, you had this really nice upside with some downside protection. And the hypothesis behind that, Dan, is in America, people don't get rid of stuff, right? It's not too dissimilar than workforce housing where, you know, you catch people on the way up, you know, they're making money and they buy things and put it in storage. And then, when they're downsizing, if things are going poorly, they downsize, they just don't get rid of their things. So, you know, that's what the kind of two basic pillars that I liked. And then the last one was really why, you know, I made the big evolution was, In storage, there are 6 publicly traded companies that own, and for your listeners who may be on the highway right now, if they look out of their window, if they're anywhere close to a populated area, there's probably a CubeSmart or an Extra Space or a Public Storage, and those are the publicly traded REITs in storage. And those companies only own about 25% of the storage market. So there's still a, very much a consolidation play in the storage asset class, where you know, you still have a lot of mom and pop operators who own one facility, two facilities. And so, you know, for a regional operator like us, there's a really nice opportunity for kind of a consolidation or roll up strategy.
Yeah, I really appreciate the intelligent decision and the investment philosophy, being able to describe the actual reason why you were attracted to self storage. I'm guilty of accidentally buying a handful of my rental properties and feel like a good deal. I mean, I have reasons why I buy where I buy, but I always am so strong to suggest that when people are investing in real estate, I mean, really investing in anything in general, Chris, you got to know why you're buying the stuff that you're buying. And I like that you were able to actually spell out exactly why and how you did the research. That was smart. So let's talk about the long-term play. You're buying in, I guess, Sunbelt, Southeastern United States markets. Is this generally because, is there other data points that, you know, the company paid attention to and reasons why you invest there? Is there an ultimate, I don't know, you're waiting for land to appreciate that you've bought these, or is it strictly a cash flow play? Like, why has Reliant focused on buying the properties that they now buy and operate?
Yeah, I mean, the metrics we're looking for in commercial storage are not too dissimilar from what you'd look for in any good real estate market, right? You know, we're chasing population growth, right? So, you know, you've obviously seen a pretty strong net population migration from the Northeast to the Southeast, right? People aren't moving to New York. They're coming to Florida. There's obviously some tax benefits. You know, Florida doesn't have a state income tax. Tennessee doesn't have a state income tax. And so you're seeing that net population migration. But honestly, the metrics we look for are not too dissimilar. Our sweet spot right now is really around value add. On the self-storage side. So it's a little bit different. Obviously, you know, multifamily value add, you can, or even the single family world, when you're flipping a house, you can throw hardwoods, granite countertops, stainless steel appliances and charge more rent or flip the house. In storage, you know, we can't put granite countertops in a garage. So what we're typically doing on the value add side is really an expansion play where, you know, we're in a market where we believe is undersupplied. And the demand drivers are going to continue to grow the self-storage demand. And so we're going to essentially expand a property, or, you know, I'm using air quotes for your listeners listening, but institutionalize the property, because ultimately our exit strategy is going to, you know, one of the publicly traded REITs or institutional money to sell the asset.
And what does the exit timeline look like? So, I mean, I read on the website, I think you guys had raised $38 million to buy somewhere close to $90 or $100 million in assets. I assume they're all self-storage related, but is that going to be a long-term hold? Is it going to be one solid, you know, large chunk where the entire $90 million is sold to the institution, or are these going to be kind of whacked off as the opportunity presents itself for each one along the way? An exit.
Yeah. So that $38 million, that was last year. That's basically the pace we've been on for about the last 3 years. Is, you know, that 10 property ish type of a acquisition, you know, $100 million a year in all in value. To answer your question, I mean, our portfolio under management right now that we own is probably, depending on the cap rate you're using to value it, but somewhere in that $350 to $450 million range. And I would say, you know, our average hold, we've sold 21 properties. The average hold on those 21 is just over 3 years, but typically we're projecting 5 to 7. You know, we're raising a fund right now, a $50 million equity fund, specifically for value add and stabilized self-storage, where the projected hold time is 6 years. But I would say that we're opportunistic, Dan, right? We would, you know, if someone brings a wheelbarrow full of money on year two and we can deliver the returns to our investors year two that we said we can get in year five, you know, we'll probably exit. But it really depends. Certainly, as you know, there's probably a little bit more value we can squeeze out of a portfolio sale than the onesie twosies, you know. So if we can get somebody to come in and say, hey, I'll buy, you know, 15 assets, you know, there's a better valuation for that and just a bigger market from the institutional side of things than there would be if it was, you know, if we were selling one property on its own.
What's the minimum investment and what does the investment structure look like? Are you raising one fund for each property or is it going to be like once each year you're raising, I don't know, whatever the 10 million or whatever it is plus that's going to buy multiple properties? Like how does that come up for investors who might be listening and thinking like, hey, I want to play?
Yeah, I think we've done both. So what you're describing is that individual syndication, and the best analogy I could give you, right, is think stocks or mutual funds. So up until this point, we've actually done individual property syndication. So like you're buying an individual stock and you invest in that one property. The fund we're doing this year is our first fund. And in the fund, basically, we're raising $50 million in equity. It'll work itself out to be, I think, about 13 properties. So you invest in the fund and essentially like a mutual fund, you know, your performance is based off the performance of 13 properties across four states and you're not relying on one. So you get that nice diversification. You know, the downside to the fund, Dan, is it's really hard for an investor to do due diligence on 13 properties. So the trust is very much more on with the operator than anything else. So that's what we're doing right now. We may go back to the individual syndication. To your question around the minimum investment, in the fund, there's three classes of investing share, and it each has its own structure. Class A is a $5 million minimum with its own waterfall structure. Class B is $1 million, and then Class C is a $50,000 minimum.
Nice. So let's talk about past performance, because if somebody's going to put some money on the table for, you know, basically taking the bet on the team here, the Reliant team, on capably investing the $50 million in 13 properties. Like you said, you can't underwrite all 13 of them. They're having to kind of make a commitment up front. So can we talk about maybe the worst deal that returned XYZ in the past, and then maybe contrast that with one of the better deals, and then maybe describe as a caveat, like, hey, this is probably what we would really expect to happen on this next one?
Yeah, we can absolutely do that. I think, you know, let me preface by saying that we've had, you know, Reliant started in 2007. We bought our first, it was actually 2005, but bought our first property in 2007, long before I was here. And so we've had one of the greatest real estate markets, at least to my generation. I'm 39. So, you know, we've benefited certainly from the market coming to meet us, and we're a pretty good operator too. I don't mean to take away anything, but you know, our returns are pretty, egregious. So, it's not certainly what we underwrite to, but, you know, we've been the beneficiary, as have our investors, to, you know, cap rate has been compressing in storage in the last 10 years, as well as the market's been crushing. So, we've definitely reaped the benefits of both of those. So let me take you through, your first question was, when you say the worst property, you're saying that we've sold?
I guess just, you know, from an investor's perspective, if they were reading like an annual report and you had to give them an update and it wasn't great news, like what was the, you know, kind of downside, if there was any of those, that took place over the last couple of years that you're aware of?
Well, I mean, we certainly have markets that have been impacted negatively. And the biggest risk in storage right now is additional supply, right? There's been a huge development cycle. You know, you don't make money in real estate and then not have other people come and do it too. You know, like we're not the only smart guys in the room for sure. I think the easiest way to answer that is I'll tell you the worst deal of the 21 that we sold, and then the best deal. And we can talk about the specific, you know, average metrics. But, you know, our worst deal was a property that we owned. It was actually one of the first properties that Reliant purchased. And it actually did really well. We refinanced it a few times along the way, but ultimately the return over the eight, we owned that one I think it was just over 8 years. Yeah, just under 9 years. And our average return was just about 18% cash on cash, a year for that nine. So the total return was 160%, but it was split over 9 years. So it wasn't, you know, it was a great return and certainly not bad, but that's honestly one of the worst performing properties we've had of the ones we've sold. We've never lost a property to the bank. Our best, and this is where, you know, the numbers start to get a bit egregious. you know, we just closed on a development property last spring in April. We sold a property in Naples that we had built that, you know, we just about tripled investors' money at an 8-pref 70-30 split was the structure. And we tripled investors' money in just over 2 years. And most don't happen that way, but we were in a really good market and kind of the hypothesis we had behind the development was correct. And so we only ran the facility for about 6 months before gave us an unsolicited offer on the property. And, you know, when you get that kind of return for your investor, it's hard to not say yes. So even though that was a property we would have liked to keep for, you know, 8 years, we did end up selling it, and obviously our investors reaped the benefits.
Was there that was a development you guys built from the ground up? Was there something about that market that you'd be able to describe easily and quickly that made that so attractive, first to you guys and then secondarily to the REIT that came in and paid a premium?
Yep. It was the parcel of land, and we actually did a JV deal with the guy who owned the land. But the parcel of land was surrounded by essentially residential. There was nowhere else that supply could be built. And so the corridor that we were on, if you wanted to have access to storage and access these residential communities on the corridor, we had the only parcel. And so what ended up happening, and I'd like to say that we were really smart and we planned on this, but one of the REITs that owned a facility on the other end of the corridor, about 5 miles down the road, ended up being the ones who purchased it. And when they purchased it, then they controlled that entire corridor on the storage side. And that was kind of, you know, we didn't plan on that part. We just kind of said, hey, this is an opportunity where, you know, it was really challenging to have any additional supply come to market. And you got all this super high-end housing that supports it from a supply or from a demand side. So it worked out really well.
I mean, Naples, this is Naples, Florida. Is that where we're talking?
Correct.
And like, what is the price point, just to paint the picture here in completion, of, you know, the housing that was surrounding this area?
You're saying of the residential?
Yeah, like what's the average house selling for along that strip? Or condo.
I'd have to go back and take a look. It wasn't super high end, but it was good, strong demographics. I want to say my gut says somewhere in that $400,000 to $600,000 range, you know. But for Naples, that's relatively cheap. Depending on where you go in Naples, but you can spend some money. But it was good, consistent growth on the residential side. And then, you know, we put a product in the middle of it that we assumed was going to lease up well, and it did.
What about the average deal? I mean, what do you think people could expect from this fund that you guys are putting together right now?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, for us, how we underwrite, you know, we're trying to underwrite with a downside in mind, right? You know, trees don't grow to the sky. There has to be some correction here somewhere, with the market that we're currently in. So, we have three buckets of deals that we do. You know, we have kind of the stabilized asset, value add, and then our development deals. And the fund really is a combination of the first two. There won't be any development deals in it. So, you know, we typically underwrite our deals to kind of that mid-teens, and the fund is no different. The fund is about a 16% cash-on-cash return over six-year holds, so a total return of 96%. That's what we're projecting. You know, certainly could be more, could be less, but that's what we project. You know, when we do development deals, we're a little bit higher than that because it's riskier, right? I mean, you got a much better chance of losing all your money, when you put a shovel on the ground and there's no cash flow for 2 years. So for us, the development deal, it withholds a lot of risk. But like I said, in that last example of that Naples project, there's a lot of upside too if we can make it work right.
So you mentioned earlier, Chris, that risk is supply, and it makes total sense. We have some of the other guests. Paul Sloat is one of our regular guests. He comes on, does like an economic update, and he watches some of the things throughout all the classes. And one of the things that he mentions over and over and over again, one is that multifamily has been overbuilt for a while and kind of chased, and that's sort of, you know, customary mention. And then the other is self-storage, and he's thinking that, you know, it's kind of oversupplied, and we're heading toward a wall or heading off a cliff, especially if a recession comes. It's and then you said also earlier in our discussion here that that you believe you're in markets where it's undersupplied. Could you speak to all those topics a little bit?
Well, I don't want to speak to the economic proudness of Paul Sloat, but you know, I think look, the interesting part about storage is, you know, let's take the multifamily piece for a second. And this is just my opinion, right? It's rooted in nothing but gut. You know, the hard part with multifamily is everybody's been saying it's oversupplied. Well, they keep leasing up. I mean, developers aren't building them because they're staying empty, you know, and certainly we have some, you know, fortuitous interest rates and a great environment in which to develop. But they're leasing up and, you know, I don't know if that's a shift that we point to generationally where, you know, the generational idea of renting versus buying is different. I guess, you know, only time will tell with that. But with storage for sure. I mean, just to give you a quick statistic, right? We have in 2017 and 2018, we delivered the most new net rentable square footage in the history of the asset class, both years. 17 was first, and then 18 outpaced 17. So that's a big number. And then 19 is supposed to be pretty close to where 18 was, and then it tails off, right? So hopefully some of the developers have said, hey, let's see what happens before we keep putting, you know, buildings up. The good news so far is there's definitely been markets that have been impacted by oversupply, and we're in some of them, right? But the interesting part about storage is it's really a sharpshooter game, Dan, where the only thing that matters is call it the 1, 3, 5, maybe 7 mile radius around your facility. You know, 70%+ of our tenants in most markets come from within that 5 mile radius. So because a market is oversupplied doesn't mean that there aren't individual pockets where there are holes, right? Like we may look at Atlanta as an MSA and say, hey, there's been too much development. Rent growth is down. But that doesn't mean that there's not a pocket in, you know, Woodstock or, you know, pick some market and insert here that you can find a hole where that 5 mile radius, you may have an opportunity. And I think that's the difference with storage is, people won't drive, right? Like with apartments or even single family homes, people will drive because of school districts or amenities or, you know, a park or the town they want to be in, taxes. With storage, it's a garage. So it's either convenient to your house or work. You know, there's no reason I'm going to drive past another self-storage facility unless, you know, pricing or the quality is different. You know, if one's next to my house and one's 10 miles down the road. So, it's really what our business is very intimate in that you need to know that 1, 3, and 5 mile radius, because that's all that really matters. And so, you know, to Paul's point, definitely there are some markets that are oversupplied. Rent growth is going down or negative to try to get those facilities leased up. But you know, I guess my feeling is there's still opportunities out there. You just have to dig. You know, and I think we're very hesitant on development because, you know, there's a different risk for development than a, you know, I'm buying a cash flowing asset that kicks off money day one and then adding some expansion to it. Is that helpful?
It is helpful. And I mean, I guess it's obvious as you're mentioning it, just like in self-storage or with multifamily apartment, there's going to be these locations in different markets where the opportunity is going to exist and be a little bit of a higher barrier to entry and you're, investment's going to perform differently. I mean, it's like Warren Buffett's ability to pick stocks. Obviously, he wasn't just buying into the market at the index fund. If he's going to beat the market, he obviously has to be a sharpshooter also. So it makes sense that you guys have figured out the targeting and had the ability to pay attention to the detail of, you know, the very specific 1, 3, and 5 mile radius and have done that enough to know when that's going to be a danger zone. I had a woman trying to sell me one in somewhere in Texas, right across the border from Mexico. And she was mentioning to me, I think her husband and her had bought it, mom and pop owner. and they were enjoying the property, and they owned two or three of them over their lifetime. And I think he passed away, and she called, and she's like, man, it used to be, you know, so much better. And now it's whatever the occupancy went from, you know, 60 to 30% or something like that. And I was talking with Paul, and that was what made me do similar of the radius search you did. And I saw, like, right there in the radius when I did the Google, you know, Google map search, there was, you know, multiple self-storage areas, so many of them right in that little vicinity there. And it was like crystal clear that was not an asset that I wanted to put any money in for sure, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I think the other thing that happens too, right, with the mom and pop operators is if you're competing against the REITs, they're going to crush you, you know, unless you're keeping pace. You know, if I do have a choice that are all convenient to me and one feels like a Starbucks when I walk in and one is, you know, a person's house on a gravel driveway and a guy in a spaghetti stained t-shirt shows up and asks when you want to rent the facility, you know what I mean? You got to keep pace. And now storage is, you know, we call it like this is second generation storage in front of the gate, right? Where, you know, you got a 3-story climate controlled building on the corner of Main and Main. You know, storage first generation was what I just described, right? Like a house in a rural area and they had some drive up storage units behind it. And now, you know, it's institutionalized. So certainly, you know, sometimes though, those mom and pops who say what you just said, it's just because they run them poorly and they are still in a great market and got to dump some equity into it to bring it up to snuff. But, you know, some of those are some of the best opportunities. You know, we salivate when we hear somebody say like, oh, it used to be good, you know, and you at least got to go look at it first.
Yeah. And I think she went on to say something about the guy that's living there and everything. And one of my other friends who does self-storage said, oh yeah, that guy's probably stealing the money. That's probably all it is. It's just, you know, so, so you guys have probably learned some lessons. I'm not sure with your position there, it sounds like you know a lot about what's going on everywhere, but is there some kind of model? I mean, you guys talk about spending some money, you're buying a property and investing some capital and kind of doing like an upgrade. What are some of the examples of the things that someone would expect, like someone who's renting storage from one of the Reliant investments? I mean, when they walk up, what's their experience like compared to the mom and pop that I was using as an example?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you think of it like any retail experience, right? 70% of our customers are women, right? So you got to feel safe, right? So well lit. Tons of natural light. Like you walk into the office, it feels like a retail showroom. So you have, you know, your locks, boxes. It's not, you know, just a desk. It, you're walking in and trying to sell some of those ancillary income items along with it. I think also just, you know, the colors, right? I mean, everything's bright and new and fresh and you're trying to create a good retail experience like you would with any, you know, consumer. So whether that's a restaurant or a retail store, storage is not, you know, not any different. I think the thing that we spend a lot of time on from a training perspective with our operational staff is really the customer service aspect because, you know, as we talked about, you're selling a garage, right? And so the differentiator is, you know, making sure that you are a great customer service agent for that tenant. Because, you know, storage is one of those things where, you know, we're a business of transition, right? So people use storage when they move. People use storage when they get divorced. People use storage when it's seasonal, right? They're coming in and out of a market. And so, you know, the opportunity to interact with those people, it's critical that they have a great experience because ultimately that's going to be one of the differentiators between, you know, us and perhaps that mom and pop operator. That isn't operating the facility like a business.
Do you find that you guys are able to generally get more money per square foot in rent, or is it a higher occupancy compared to, I guess, everybody's price shopping, or is there some combination of that depending on the market?
Yeah, probably a little bit of what you just, the latter, a combination. I mean, our model is built around economic occupancy being the critical component versus physical. The REITs, the publicly traded REITs, actually that's how they do business. So if you get into a REIT facility and it's brand new, you'll pay very little to get into the unit and they'll fill it up with, you know, we underwrite some of those deals where a REIT might be managing a third party management of a facility that they don't own and that, you know, that owner wants to sell. And sometimes you'll see a spread between the physical occupancy and the economic occupancy of, you know, we just looked at the facility. It was like 55% physically occupied, which is great. They had just opened. It's a new facility. But the economic occupancy was like 12.
So, oh, my,
you know,
gosh.
Yes, there's a lot of people in there, but none of them are paying any money. And the goal is, you know, you get them full and then you start to ratchet up the rent behind it. Our model has always been a little bit different in that we're focused more on the economic side, where we're going to push rents as, you know, as hard as we can and not focus so much on the physical occupancy, with the goal being, you know, driving NOI. So it's a balance. It certainly depends on the market too, you know, how much supply is in the market and the demand, but it's always kind of the levers that we're trying to manipulate on the operation side to maximize the revenues.
Gotcha. Makes sense. So I guess a little bit of a wrap up question here, Chris. I don't know if it would be maybe from like the investor's perspective, somebody who is maybe going to put money in, or even from the operator side, or someone who's just curious about everything we talked about. Is there any other pieces of information that I was too ignorant to ask that you might touch on?
You're saying specific to storage?
I mean, I guess, yeah, specific to what we've talked about. So we've kind of focused on storage. So yeah, I guess, like, you know, is there anything I forgot to ask because I'm not in the business and I wouldn't know to, that you feel like the listeners should know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little bit different in that it's a heavily management intensive business, right? Where you don't have, you know, toilets, plumbing, electricity, but you do have tenants that have 30-day leases. So, you know, the business part of storage, there's almost two components to it, the real estate aspect, but then there's also a business. And, you know, we have 160 employees and 140 of them are out running facilities. So, you know, there's a big business part of, you know, ensuring your people are trained correctly. You hit the nail on the head a little bit earlier when you said, hey, your buddy said they're probably just stealing money. The hard part with a lot of passive storage investors is they just hire somebody to go in, and that somebody gets more responsibility than they should. And it's real easy for, you know, things to go awry. So it's because the leases are only 30 days, there can be good and bad to that, right? Where you can adjust rents and grow revenue very quickly, but you can also lose occupancy and lose that revenue. So it's kind of both sides of the coin there. And I would just say to the listeners who say, hey, I'm interested, like, storage is an interesting business to me, just keep in mind the management side is a heavily intensive part of it, and a critical piece to driving successful revenue. And that's where, you know, you have a lot of companies who will do third party management out there that they can help with, you know, some of the expertise on the management side if you can find the real estate.
Am I correct in assuming the 160 employees, you guys are all in-house management, clean across the board? That's a big part of the value you're bringing to anything you buy. Am I right with that assumption, Chris?
Yeah, you're correct. So, you know, the majority of those employees are literally the guys and gals behind the desk. So when someone walks into one of our facilities, they're doing the renting there. And we manage all of our properties that we own. We have a few properties that we're just third party managers on, but not really a model we're looking to pursue.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, the big money's in driving up the value of the assets here and selling them. It is really a cool thing you guys put together there, where you have 140 odd people who somewhere along the organization, best practices are bubbling up, trickling over, transferring back and forth. And I'm sure that the lessons learned throughout that volume of deals are, or would take a lifetime for the average mom and pop investor to come up with all those little nuances that you guys have had the opportunity from scale to enjoy. I guess my final question here for book recommendations, Chris, and it's, we don't have to limit it to self-storage or anything like that, but are there, you know, one or two books that maybe have kind of changed your life or your perspective along the way that you feel like us real estate investors would think might be equally cool?
I'm going to give you the hokiest answer ever. When you said changed your life, I don't really have a better answer than this. Rich Dad, Poor Dad for me was like when I was, I don't know, 27 was like the, oh, that's what I was missing. Like I distinctly remember waking up and I was doing really well on the sales side and made a bunch of money. And I remember waking up thinking, I don't think I can do this for another 30 years. And Rich Dad Poor Dad for me was sort of the, oh, that's how you make your money, make money, not, you know, trading time for money. Cause I was pretty good at that. Like I could work pretty hard and make good money. But I realized pretty quickly that that's not the way I wanted to go. So, without being too hokey, you know, I'm sure everybody knows that one, but Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad Poor Dad was certainly a life changer for me. I'll give you one more that I think is a really interesting book. Maybe not life changing, but certainly life validating. It's called The Alchemist and it's by this guy by the name of Paulo Coelho. I think he was Brazilian. And the story is actually interesting. He wrote the book in like the 50s and it was an abstract failure. And then some publisher got a hold of it, republished it, and it became, I think, one of the best selling books in the world, something like that. But it's a story about kind of following your journey. And it's more of like a life and philosophical. If you Google it, you know, it's all over the place. But my wife gave it to me a long time ago and that was a really interesting read.
That's cool. I got chills when you mentioned that because it's definitely the first time somebody on the show has mentioned The Alchemist, but I also read it. Somebody handed it to me and it was not a business acquaintance and it wasn't recommended on a podcast. And it's not like you're going to sit down and figure out self-storage from reading that one. But it's sure. It's definitely that like that life guidance and like reinforcement that you're on the right path kind of thing is sort of what I took away from it. Great book recommendations. I appreciate that. So let's just say, Chris, if you were going to go back to, you know, 27, you read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, you were selling and you're all of a sudden getting ready to make a shift into real estate. What would be the crown jewel of wisdom, knowing what you know now, that you would share with yourself back then 10, 12 years ago, if you could, to help the journey?
Well, I would have liked 27-year-old Chris to tell 20-year-old Chris. That would have been the first thing. Start sooner. I wish, you know, look, I'm a believer that every step of your journey kind of gets you to where you are today. So, I don't mean to say that I regret, but certainly time is a very powerful investment tool, as you know. So probably one nugget would be, hey, start soon. And then, you know, the second thing that's really been a huge part of my career and is to this day is find partners who know or who complement your skill sets or fill in the gaps where you don't. I know what I'm good at. And I know what I don't like and I'm not that good at. And so I've been very fortunate, to have great partners along the way who have filled in the gaps and been mentors to me in the things that I'm not good at. And at Reliant, that's no different. You know, Todd Allen, who's my partner here, is a fantastic operational guy. And that's not my ballywick. And so for people who are, you know, either just starting or trying to find that next level for themselves, like, you know, the best people are not people, they're teams, right? So it's not one guy or gal who's going to get you there. It's finding that group that's all rowing in the same direction. So that would be another thing that I would tell myself is, you know, that you don't have to do this on your own. Go find somebody to mentor you and take you along for the ride.
Yeah, well said. So if anybody wants to get some more information about Reliant or you personally, do you have a website or any contact information that you'd like to share, Chris?
Yeah, for sure. I think it depends what you want to do. I'm on LinkedIn under Chris Benson. It's Chris with a K. So K-R-I-S-B-E-N-S-O-N. Pretty active there on the real estate side. We also have a website. It's actually chrisbenson.com with a nice little educational series on real estate investing. It's all free. Just have to enter your email address. It was really, we built that so that investors who would ask all these questions, I can just forward them to one place and, you know, it's a good start. And I don't have to have the same conversation 50 times. And then the last one, if you're interested more about our platform at Reliant, it's reliantinvestments.com. And that's a, gives you more information on the firm, overview on our track record, those kinds of things.
All right, cool. Well, that brings us to the top of our time together here. Chris, I appreciate you blocking out the distractions and sharing. I have pages and pages of notes here from our conversation. I'm sure everybody listening does too. So thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Keep an eye out for the next one. Ivan Barrett and I discuss his journey from house hacking a duplex to owning more than $300 million in commercial real estate. Ivan was introduced through a mutual friend, and we circled schedules for months before finally getting this episode recorded. Wait until you hear Ivan's story about being buried in debt as the markets crashed back in 2007, 2008, to building an apartment building portfolio with more than 3,000 units today in 2019. You'll have to tune in next time for the full details. Are you interested in a pre-release access of that episode? That is, before the email goes out. When you subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, you'll receive an advance notification as soon as the episode is published, as opposed to Saturday when the email is sent. Prefer the email? Just head over to reidiamonds.com and sign up. Attention deal makers, I am buying. I buy houses and apartment complex deals in Atlanta, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Florida. If you have a deal, please contact me directly using the form at reidiamonds.com. Are you an accredited investor who is interested in short-term passive mortgage investment opportunities with double-digit returns? Head over to fundrehabdeals.com and check out the available high-yield investment opportunities. We have reached the end, my friends. Thank you again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.